This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Adrienne Hill. So that's really the question. Are we ready to change the way we interact with our cash? Daniel Egan is the Director of Behavioral Finance at the investment advisor Betterment. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So first thing off, you've called yourself a financial technophile, which means you're probably well-versed in some of the alternative currencies and payment systems we just heard about. And I was wondering how those applications have changed the way you do things.
So this is actually a great point. The answer is, unfortunately, not tremendously.
Why not?
While I love being an early adopter, the fact is nobody's actually hit the holy grail of substituting for cash, making something that's much easier. And this is really interesting. When you think about the money that's been put into financial innovation over the past two decades or so, there have been tremendous amounts spent, which usually to the benefit of a very few set of people. So if you think about the fact that we can invest money to lay fiber optic cable across the Arctic Circle to make trades happen milliseconds faster, that's a lot of money. And yet I still have to pay 2.5 to 3% on any credit card transaction. And I think that's where we're not seeing efficiencies and innovations that would hit the average consumer like you or me very well. The fact is, it is still easier to go into your wallet, pull out $3 cash to pay for a coffee, put it on the table and walk away, than it is to take out your smartphone, unlock it, get into the app, interact with the whatever vendor it is, and then pay for it that way.
When we do get there, I mean, what challenges does that pose for having us be sort of mindful consumers, especially as we live in a society of debt and bankruptcy?
This is one of the key ones. I think we're going to really judge these developments and, you know, quote unquote improvements by how much they benefit the average person. So things like that track your purchases and your financial habits, things like Mint, the benefit to that company, the reason you get that service that looks at your spending habits is because they're able to sell that data onto somebody else who's going to use it to understand you better. Sometimes for better, sometimes because they're going to refer service providers that are actually going to help you out a lot more, but a lot of times because they want to figure out pricing on various things. How can they figure out how to charge you the right amount? And I think, how do we compensate individual consumers for sharing that data with these providers who are going to use it for sometimes good and sometimes bad is really the core question. Do you own your data, and how much of a benefit do you get from sharing it so easily?
Yeah. And another thing I'm wondering about is when I go into Starbucks, for example, and I actually have to count out the dollar bills and hand them over, you know, at least I'm taking that moment where I'm like, yes, this is $3 worth of coffee I'm buying. If I just have my phone in my pocket, I don't even have that moment of consideration. And I wonder what that means for us as spenders and as you think about behavioral economics. If even the hurdle of taking the dollars out of my wallet goes away, what's it mean?
I actually think I'm possibly a bit optimistic. I actually think there's going to be an improvement there, which is that, number one, you can have a smartphone app that's going to say you've already spent $20 this month on coffee.
You're going over
your budget, do that in real time. And, you know, it can ping you those little pain points like, hey, this means that, you know, it's going to take you another 2 months to buy those new pair of shoes that you were thinking about. I also think that the way we think about that, so you have a sort of system of doing where, you know, I have friends who take out $100 a week and that's what they're going to spend that week. Now, I think far better is if you actually have something technological that puts hard limits on that, and that shows you sort of your safe to spend amount as you go through the week. So I think that a little bit of setup on your part of saying, this is my budget, this is what I want to spend on various things, and having something that gives you that real-time feedback, possibly in a more informative or emphatic way, will actually be better than cash.
That's very interesting. So you could imagine a future where my phone would be like, no, you can't buy coffee. I've set some pre-assigned limit and my phone says, no, sorry.
I actually think that's where we want to go. Most people do a budget and it has no teeth.
Right?
You can set up a budget, but the fact is, if I spend an extra $100, what's my budget going to do about it? Are you going to, you know, come and break my knees? Of course not. You're just a budget. So I do think that getting to a point where there are hard stops on those things and where you voluntarily accept to have those stops is fantastic behaviorally. And, you know, as somebody who looks at and thinking about the behavior of people rather than just, you know, a pure economic view of them, these things are very interesting. I actually think about cash in the same way. So a lot of, you know, to your point that you just said, the basics is that with credit cards, if we spend on a credit card, the pain of payment is divorced from the pleasure of consumption.
Right.
Right? Now, the same thing is actually true a little bit with cash. Because in order to get cash, you need to go to an ATM machine, you need to deal with that, you have to find one that hopefully isn't going to charge you a fee in your area, and sometimes does charge you a fee in your area, take it out and then spend it later. So the pain of dealing with the withdrawal component of it is divorced from the pleasure. And I think that actually that's something that leads you to have more cash, because you say, I'm going to stop by an ATM and then I'll carry the cash around with me. It would be much better if you didn't have to stop at ATMs to take cash out at all.
You know, a lot of these technologies are really for people who can afford smartphones and people who have bank accounts and have credit cards. And we know a lot of the population is unbanked or can't afford these technologies. And I wonder what the future looks like for them.
When you look at how these especially mobile technologies and smarter technologies have been used throughout the world and within America, they're accelerating the rate of adoption amongst lower income people much quicker. So probably the biggest case study of success in this actually comes from Africa, from places like Kenya, where they don't have a traditional banking sector. They don't have banking branches. They use their mobile phones. They aren't even smartphones. They use their mobile phones to process transactions and send money to one another. So they've actually leapfrogged what we think of as our traditional banking sector. You actually see the same thing or a very similar thing amongst lower income people here in the US. They're not going to pay for a cable subscription for high-speed internet at home, but they will pay for an iPhone and they will pay to use the banking apps on that iPhone. And I think that in terms of the pace at which these tools and services begin being offered for the very big people and they then trickle down through time to the average consumer, you can think things like cars and TVs, which were very high-end luxury items when they first came out. The pace at which the average consumer is benefiting from these things is coming very, very rapidly compared to how they did throughout history.
Daniel Egan is the Director of Behavioral Finance at the investment advisor Betterment. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
We want to know what you think about these new technologies. Good, bad, or meh. Send us your thoughts. MarketplaceMoney.org.